if we're comfortable with that, perhaps let us together quickly run through the outstanding issues. I've got so many notes on this that I've actually completely lost track of what is happening, what is not. I want to appeal to the wisdom of the partial and advocate that came from the other side, the entire human capacity that we have. Can I just check with the firms whether there are any issues we would regard as outstanding, so that we deal with them or deal with them? From the first draft of the bill, which Timothy might want to consider, is the sort of rainy day provision. It doesn't provide for the minister to move technical amendments to the committee or from the floor to the House. That was in the original draft. So we have had a problem a few years ago when the wrong reference to a municipality in the division of revenue in the appropriation, but it couldn't be changed. Budget office has been mentioned, and with that one would look at the commencement provisions of the book. So there should be regulations, the sub-issue there, who is going to bring this bill into operation, is the bill itself with a date, or is it going to be a publication, or a date determined by the executive authority of Parliament, or by Parliament? Can it be brought into operation piecemeal, especially thinking that we must establish the budget office before we start the procedure? And then there's some issues on the wording, but we'll get to them when we go clause by clause. Thanks.
Okay. Any about 10 minutes of members here?
Chair,
Actually, I don't know if I might have missed it, but we decided that it's 76. I know that we had some debate on that at some stage.
We'll leave that with the system until when the time comes. But depending on what is in the bill, when we refer to the potential, they look at the bill as this ingredient that I would tell us. Unfortunately, we have tied ourselves to what we did not intend. It's then that we take a decision of whether we the areas that may be substituted if we want to move them by and then kind of I'd imagine it should be left to the point. Take a point by the movement of time to play the game. When we the last time we met, there was the issue of revenue amendment of the new law. That's what I thought we were now going to go back to, because we were going through the bill at that point and we were at the passing of the revenue law. We had a discussion there which we did not conclude. So now, you want us to do that. So that after that, we can then go back to look at the outstanding issues.
I'll just say what this is, and I think the draft would help us with the phrase. You would recall that the last time we met, there was a debate about what should be followed, or what should be considered when Parliament amends the revenue law. Because the argument that at that stage was that when you look at the appropriation side, there are certain factors that have to be taken into consideration, but the revenue amendment of tax legislation was quite limited. So I'll propose here that we should look into that, and my proposal would be that Parliament should consider certain things when they amend the revenue law. For instance, to follow principles of good tax system with specific reference to issues of efficiency, equity, ease of collection. And also, I mean, at one stage we had a debate with the National Treasury around obtaining a proper balance between direct taxes and indirect taxes. And the question then that we had was that there's a trend within the OECD for more reliance on indirect taxes. And the response that we got from the country, which we found satisfactory at that stage, was that in South Africa, fortunately, we have that balance, because indirect taxes, in most instances, would be consumption taxes, and they are aggressive and they tend to impact negatively on the livelihood of the poor. The other issue which I think National Treasury is in our hearing didn't understand properly, which I raised, was around the issues of macroeconomic convergence. You recall here that in SADC, National Treasury or government have got this project of tax harmonization and coordination. And I'll strongly oblige or ask that when Parliament amends revenue laws, they should take into consideration those efforts. For instance, and let me just use a practical example. In one of our hearings, we raised the International Treasury that one of our neighbors was cutting tax drastically to the point that it could be perceived to be a harmful tax practice. And the response we got there was that there's this tax harmonization or coordination effort, and that National Treasury will be meeting with some of these people and raising it and say, either we have got an agreement that there should be a race to the bottom. So I'm saying, as Parliament, we can't then go and take decisions that are contrary to what has been agreed on in Sunday. And then make, for example, I'm just using a practical example, then we go for a race to the bottom, cutting, crushing taxes abnormally. The last point also is on international tax threats, that Parliament should consider those threats because they have a main impact on our economy. Not saying that Parliament should be bound by that, but to consider that when they amend money law. The last issue is also for Parliament to consider the impact of such amendments on economic growth, development, and equity, because we can't just do something that is harmful to our economy. So I think those are the broad issues that I would say the draft has not much to do to come up with the appropriate framework. I'm not sure whether you want to refer some of the issues to the fiscal framework and I don't know.
Are there any comments to what Mr. Gardner has just raised? Because I pick up that at the end of the submission, he indicated which what kind of thought I was also going to recommend. Perhaps we should check whether some of that does not belong to the framework, because it actually has to do with not undermining the entire. The next item there was the towards the end was the issue of the national adjustment. Are there any comments, any additions? The kind of members of us are there.
I'm not coming with any proposal, but I'm just saying we should help each other here. There was a concern that was raised by members of what they said. This adjustment appropriation have to be qualified in terms of the PFMA, because people are saying, are they really unforeseeable or whatever? And I think we need to find a way of I don't know whether we leave open as it is, or we want people to beef up on it. Because people are arguing that some of these things were foreseeable. And nothing really extraordinary about it. And whether Parliament should be taken then, they are not, the party is not acceptable.
What do you recommend in putting in the legislation to give effect to that if we were to do that? Because I'm not saying agree that we would have that, because in terms of the technical it says that the next time a statement by the and it says the presentation of the FMA. And then it goes on when that is the appropriation of the national adjustment budget. But let's look at what we have there and then see what it is that we might do like what how we might want to refine it in order for it to be
I members remember in the previous meeting, I think after we got on the The DMI only makes provision for adjustment budgets, which by this rule then includes the special adjustments that Parliament has seen. So I don't think it's necessary in this legislation to refer to both. What did you speak about the adjustment budget? The special adjustment budget is doesn't really have a basis law as such. It's a name that we put on the adjustments that come through outside of the cycle. I just want to know, I'm getting old, so I get forgetful now, but the issue of financing, you know, the SCOPA bills that they put through, you know, when SCOPA ratifies spending, and then the finance bills that come through, like, are those would be appropriations? So then we would have to have that included under the authority of the Appropriations Committee, if I'm correct. We can just have that included.
I think it makes logical sense, because at the end of the day, Yeah.
Council would make the recommendation, and the executive would then, several would come down, and then the executive draws up the bill that would then get referred to the Appropriations Committee. Just a question of special pensions, something that's also, forgive me, Chair, just about other things that we might not have looked at. And that's a question of unfunded mandates. In other words, when Parliament passes legislation that is going to have financial implications, and the people who suffer most are the municipalities, most often, who get dumped with huge amounts of unfunded mandates, both from the provincial and national level. Is there any way that this legislation should be looking at the question of unfunded? I know with the American Congressional Budget Office, the American Congress, when they passed that legislation, they said that one of the standing tasks of the budget office is to present a report on unfunded mandates to the Appropriations Committee, I think it is, or to the Congress as a whole. And I don't know if that's the route we want to take or what the route we would want to choose on that.
Where would we locate unfunded mandates? Also, you have to, the appropriation of collections, the responsibility also of unfunded mandates.
Chair, I think we raised this particular point in a different context before. Where every bill, that's presented to any committee has a section financial implications, then they always have none. That's what I was going to say. But yet, if you look at what that bill means in terms of implementation, it's going to cost a lot of money to somebody. So I think departments must be obliged to work out the financial implications of any piece of presentation that they put before committee. And the Committee on Appropriations must make it their duty to ensure that is there. Otherwise, you don't pass the vote.
I don't know. Are they not obliged to do that? Are departments not obliged to do that, but then as you both correctly said, that they would just say that. And, okay, so how do you agree with
it just strikes me that there's a whole area of the relationship between policy and its funding
The next one is the passing of other manifest. If there are any comments that and the last one is the establishment of the budget office, and then we can go back to the
budget. Okay, on the talking of other manifest, where on the
and
inclusive process, because I mean, then when you look at the fiscal framework, you have to consider all things that will impact on that. And that just makes absolutely sense to do that.
How does a money bill then really something, that's appropriate money or connect revenue? How does that impact on the vision of revenue? So a national can just help support itself. National government. Thank you. queries that have before the committee now, it's whether A, whether these limitations strike the right balance between discipline in Parliament to make sure that it's acting in the best interest and in the best medium and ultimate interest of the country, and on the other hand, whether it provides sufficient powers for Parliament to bolster or strengthen the accountability of government departments and the institutions in using public funds.
Exactly said what I was going to say, you know, what the fiscal responsibility and the fiscal framework that actually limits us, even if the budget at the moment or the part that we have at the budget at the moment are open ended, so to speak. The threshold we're talking about earlier on, treasury, that's a vision that we gave us this degree, this was issue two, but the fiscal framework actually and the fiscal responsibility limits us to say we must look into the macroeconomic stability and how much can it afford us. However, I don't think if we want to be explicit, you know, we cannot do so much. Just put a clause in that, you know, we can not go beyond perhaps so much of GDP or so much of what is presented to us. But I think it is the fiscal responsibility and the fiscal framework that they should be in that.
I think that for me, the bill is crafted to adequate because it gives Parliament the full power, the full range of all those powers. Because if Parliament wants to adjust the budget upwards, then that would automatically mean they have to reject the fiscal framework and then ensure that those adjustments are taken into consideration. And if they want to do it between the votes, I think that's adequate to address. The problem I have is if you start to put in limits, you get too complex. I think as it's worded now, if Parliament wants to adjust upwards, they've got full power to do that.
I agree that the initial decisions on the division of revenues, particularly, and the fiscal framework, does have certain limitations on parliamentary remains. But I'm now not looking at the broad thing, I'm looking at the individual departments now, or the departmental budget, what can happen there. And, you know, there could be a temptation to say, okay, we won't increase expenditures, but we can, you know, move this here and shut this here and take that there. And we can also try and cut other people's money as well from other committees and from other portfolios and whatever. And, you know, what I would like firstly in response to what I'm saying here is in the opening statement on this bill, you know, it says where the constitution requires. I would say that I would want a clause that says something along the line, and it's hinted at in these clauses, but I'm not sure that it's strong enough, that in Parliament's powers to amend the money bill, it still recognises the executive prerogative to implement the legislation, the policies. It still respects the executive's authority to govern. Do you know what I mean? Because I
think we don't want a situation where Parliament is vying with the executive in terms of setting up a whole budget that completely undermines. And I mean, a DG can then quite legitimately say, once that budget has been very critical, say, listen, I can't take responsibility for this budget anymore. You moved it around so much. I told you what I could achieve with those amendments. Or what I could achieve was put before me, but now you've changed the very fundamental basis of this all. And now that undermines my executive ability to implement. I mean, Parliament can very well say, well, we've given you the responsibility to do it, but where are the dividing lines? So I think we do need to have crystallized somewhere an understanding of what this amendment power was about. Not trying to rival the executive authority. It's simply there to correct the executive on matters that are most pertinent. So if we could have that in the founding statement, at least at least a legislative intention of that. But the second thing is, we've gone through this before, the ability to amend is extremely limited because you've got contractual obligations, you've got to pay employees, you've got all kinds of obligations, and most of the budgets are salaries apart from, and you might even have contractual obligations in terms of infrastructure commitments and capital commitments. I don't know if Alter can assist us, but I know that there are parliaments that impose that say, should you want to change any line item by more than, say, 5% of the total budget of the department, then that would require scrutiny of the Appropriations Committee. If you wanted to do it less, you can do it less. But that does reach into, on a technical way, that people can try and exploit that. But I'm not happy with it just being totally open-ended, that you can make as many amendments as you like.
Yeah, Chair, I don't know if what colleague Hogan is saying is not provided for already in this bill with the safeguards and the procedures. If a DG or a minister thinks that Parliament's making unreasonable amendments or requests to amend, they'll have an opportunity here, and then the Committee on Appropriations must consider it. Should we actually state that what's quite obvious, unless you want to give it more? So there are those procedures.
Mr. Chair, to some extent that already covers my point, because I mean, if you look at the definition of a fiscal framework, it means framework for a specific financial year and gives effect to the national executive's macroeconomic policy and includes. So to a certain extent, I think it already encompasses that. It obviously makes often sense to spell out certain things, but I just think to a large extent it's already been implied. And obviously, we don't want to rewrite every act within another act to confirm certain things. And also the reference to the PFMA, I think, covers that to a large extent. In terms of the last point that Honourable Owen mentioned about whether you must put certain limitations that, yes, to a certain extent, I would also agree that to just have an open-ended thing is probably not a good thing, because it can leave it open for misuse, and I'm not sure what the approach is in other best practice examples, but I would I like the idea that you restrict them to a certain extent, without leaving the door open for other opportunities of conniving, if I can use that very, very strong word, in moving funds around.
Thank you, Chair. I've read a document here
about the process in Canada. It says here, while the committees cannot increase the level of the estimate on a particular item, they are able to reduce the proposed level, and they can also then influence future spending by examining departmental reports on plans and priorities. And more or less what this bill is trying to do. Influencing the outer years. And the article distinguishes between the presidential system and the parliamentary system. And instead of course the presidential system, the USA for instance, Parliament basically draws up the budget and has this issue with the called budget empowerment by the president, where Parliament or the Congress tells the president spend like this or that, and the president simply refuses to spend. And then that gave rise to the Budget Empowerment Act, which establishes a budget office, and which then gives the Congress there the power to actually counter that measure of the president. And they came with all kinds of rules. That was just an example that the article used to get to the Canadian system. Now, which is a parliamentary system, and the rule applying there is if you amend the budget, it stands amount to a vote of no confidence. But Canada moved beyond that. They said, no, we're not going to take a vote of no confidence when we amend the budget, but we're going to amend it in a way that's responsible and that gives effect to the parliamentary power. And this is what this bill is also trying to do. But in doing that, one must carefully look at this bill. In my view, that there are at least three levels where you're going to start making amendments. That is firstly on the level of the budget itself, the macro level. Then on the level of division between departments, and then also the level of programs or issues within a department or an entity or a public entity or a constitutional institution. So if one wants to think of, and I'm not seeing it clearly in the bill yet, is when one says, can we get we're binding ourselves to fiscal responsibility, but primarily also to your fiscal framework. Now, in terms of this bill, the fiscal framework is part of your medium-term budget policy statement. And it says, if I'm reading it correctly, that when that medium-term budget policy statement is introduced, that must include an amended fiscal framework, if there is an amendment, following from your adjustment, appropriation, and so on and so on. And then also your fiscal framework, your proposed fiscal framework for your next 2 years. Now, what I'm reading here is someone would ask me, what are we supposed to adopt when we adopting a fiscal framework or amending a fiscal framework? I would say those are 3 years, the other 2 years. So we're going to try and adopt then your, if we're getting our MCDPS this year, this is think of the future in 2 or 3 years time from now. Part of that is your after 2 years of your fiscal framework. We're going to look at the middle one and say this is now the fiscal framework for next year with these estimates, and we require those estimates to be included. Do we require then estimates? Because what we adopt there, this is what I'm trying to say, Chair. What we adopt then, those estimates, we're going to bind ourselves to those. And if we adopt an estimate. Yeah. Well, no, if we get our MTBPS now in September, October, which reviews or revises the fiscal framework for this year, we're going to start tinkering with the one for next year, next financial year. April, in terms of today, April 2009 to 10. Okay. So, what's included in that fiscal framework would be critical. Because if estimates are included there for departments and we adopt that, we will bind ourselves to not being able to shift funds between departments. If we include even the detail of estimates of programs there and we bind ourselves to those, then we're bounded by those programs as well. So one must think, what do you want in that fiscal framework and what are we going to adopt? Are we going to do those three levels? Are we going to do the estimates for the total budget? If we want to implicate that kind of procedure, or do we want estimates of departments, institutions, public entities, or they're not usually, maybe in the future they'll take care of themselves. But so what in that fiscal framework will bind us? And that's not clear yet in this piece of legislation. And one must think then, in terms of drafting, do we want to put that in regulations, so we can amend it easier, change as we see how this bill is implemented later, or do we want to at least set a basic standard in the bill to say at least one meets the estimates of total budget and of departments, and then we can move both within a department and between departments. But there are implications either way. Thank you, Chair.
And Chair, I think I differ a bit. more look at the fiscal framework presented to the ESCO and provide recommendations in a report that will give the executive a signal that there might be a problem if they come with a similar materially unchanged framework in February. But then in February, Parliament adopts the fiscal framework, which is quite clearly defined in the bill, including aggregate revenue, aggregate expenditure, aggregate borrowing, as we define it. So the fiscal framework actually says all that Parliament adopts at that point is the aggregate amount. It does not, it's quite clear already, but it doesn't adopt anything around the division of revenue or anything around specific departmental ceiling. And if I understood the committee correctly, the reason for separating the levels out is that you actually want, when you look at the fiscal framework, you will be looking at spending issues because it is part of the overall economy, how government spends its funds. But the issues that you want to use in order to consider the fiscal framework is that it's macroeconomic issues. We do not want to know about specific departmental spending issues because the ceiling that you impose is that hard ceiling within which trade-off spend, like in any budget process, centrally needs to be made eventually within the appropriation committee. And so I think the bill that stands currently is quite clear that the fiscal framework is aggregate revenue, aggregate expenditure, aggregate borrowing for a relevant financial year, which is then adopted in February for that year, with the just projection for the following two years.
My understanding is that I think my understanding is in terms of the forces is that I don't know what it's in the bill now, and I've been 16, but when we were looking at the medium-term budget policy statement, my understanding was that we don't adopt it per se, but that we provide a report on the medium-term budget policy statement. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? With the medium-term budget policy statement, we don't adopt it, we report on it, and we make recommendations in relation to it.
Correct. Yeah.
Is that correct?
Thank you, Chair. No, what I was trying to say, and I was saying to officers as well, that when we have this clause on the division of revenue and the introduction of the national budget, there's nowhere in this bill that there's a statement of your fiscal framework, a document saying this is the fiscal framework we're going to adopt. The only thing I find is your proposed fiscal framework in terms of the NCBDS. So if we want that, and that is your practice in the line of reliance on the license of operation, then let's put it in there, then it must say this.
Yes, Joe, it should be in Clause 8.1 where we list that the national budget should be tabled together with the appropriation on the revenue board that should also be the fiscal framework, which has been adopted in the next
Can I then just raise an issue in relation to this when we're talking about whether we have powers, or you know, whether we want to limit powers or put certain more conditions into the powers to amend? The issue that I'm not sure that we've satisfied here is what is the shape of the appropriation bill? Is it the line items? Is it the programs? What is it that we're adopting in the appropriation bill? Or the discussion?
There's an instinct that the ball must be able to allow
some limits on the amendment so that committees don't start micromanaging and take over the powers of the executive. Is that in the bill there is the safeguard that amendments need to be motivated concerns and or in view of mostly to be exact phrase, but in view of the performance report that is done in October. To my mind that would mean that the committee cannot come and say that the department should spend money on something that hasn't actually proposed or that isn't linked to the review of policy and performance that was taken in November. On the third issue that I think we should talk about is the appropriation bill. The current form of the appropriation bill allocates funds to programs. That doesn't allocate funds. It doesn't within the program make a distinction between recurrent and capital spending. It doesn't transfer. It just allocates the funds to the program to each department, and then it allocates the transfers that need to go to public entities that are funded through the department, but or the transfers, you know, those are details. But it's actually just at the program level. So an amendment, on because of the nature of the appropriation bill, an amendment wouldn't be moving funds from even from one sub-program to another program. It would be between programs. And then there the PMMA already actually allows the department to move up to 8% from one program to another one. So they already have quite a lot of discretion given the practices of the Commission Act. So technically, the Commission asked itself, what is it that the department will be able to amend when it wants to signal that there's a problem or wants to change or make the department more responsible for its performance. And technically, they can move funds between programs. And in a way that would need to be even more than 8%. If you look at it next to the environment power that the accounting officer already has. But of course, the more significant amendment is likely to be between years. Not only moving between programs, but a committee may want to say to the department, you are not going to spend this fund this year on this program, because look, last year we also allocated funds here, but we never used the additional funds. So why are you again allocating additional funds to this program when actually you haven't set up sufficient capacity to do it? And there's another program which you say is a priority, which is not being funded currently. So move the funds from this year to that program, and then in the outer 2 years, you may want to then fund to the level that you are currently spending. But the problem, of course, is that we don't have multi-year appropriations for anything. The goal should set up that system, and I think the question is whether the performance report that we've got in the goal, that the committee has in the goal, whether that is sufficient in terms of setting up that and then just on these practices, there are two limitations, besides the substantive limitations as the manager to say that the committee can only decrease expenditure and cannot increase. The other two forms of rules that Parliament proposes in itself, the one is to say the percentage rule, that it cannot change more than a certain percentage of the vote, which would then provide the sympathy, etc. And the second rule is to say that it can only pass, any committee can only make 5 amendments. And within the committee then it needs to trade off the different amendments that it might want to make. In favor of any consideration of 5 different amendments. There's some parliaments where that is not in place, and a limitation like that is not in place. Committees come with so many, with thousands of amendments, but of course then if you look at our system, we allocate the program. So it's unlikely that there will be 1,000 amendments coming from any committee, because all that they have is 60 to be.
things that I'm seeing, I'm not sure whether it's the real one or the imagined one. We might find a situation where we might not be able to translate anything into the information presented to Parliament without that agreement. And we just find that broad. So I'm not sure where you'll be able to get the detailed information. Would you be in the first place? I don't know. But if I think of my, let's say the program, let's take social development, we just say child care. Let's say within the department, child care, and it doesn't tell you much about personnel expenditure or capital expenditure. What are you going to amend? What are you going to think of? Because we are facing this cost statement, and the department is the only one that knows what is in that cost statement, but Parliament doesn't know. So therefore, they are at an advantage that they can, through violence, change things, because they can see the details that we can't. That's the challenge that I'm seeing.
Okay. I'll try to refer to the budget review recommendation report that we spoke about. But also, you know, that I think that's why our budget office is going to be such a critical engine, because you know that's the availability of information and being able to tell the people.
So the budget office can only really deal with information that's available to the committee. I think the issue that we're pondering here is, now I'm trying to think now in Parliament, what would be the kind of amendments that the portfolio committee would like to make? I know one portfolio committee would not, are very worried about five prisons that have never been built for 15 years or something. I'm trying to think of the nature, because knowing the National Treasury program, that's the part that I'm most familiar with. You know, you've got asset and liability management, and you've got policy, and you've got revenue, and you know, they are such discrete and homogenous entities that your amendments are likely to be within a program, not between programs. Because what are you going to shift from policy to asset and liability management? And you know, I would imagine that maybe we all need to, over this weekend, go and look at our estimates of national expenditure and go through those departments and just look at those programs. What are they? Because the programs are huge. They cover a huge amount. So if you're simply going to be voting on six figures within a department, you know, six total, it doesn't give you much room to maneuver at all. And you see, then the other question that you raised, or Maloto, the information on the strategic plan and budget only comes after the tabling of the expenditure, the estimates of expenditure. Now, what are we looking at the committee? Are we looking at the strategic plan? That's when we start looking at the budget. I would imagine that is. That's the document that we're looking at.
Okay. Thank you. I think we must learn from that article. You know how to move money with this. From the other program to the other this year, and the next year they move it back to the program.
Then can I make a recommendation? Can I recommend that the next 10 DGs that we've offered sound the budget office?
Or chair, they use suspense accounts, like we read in the report yesterday. Some departments use suspense accounts. Just move it there, later on they bring it back, foreign affairs, and I think it was housing, in the first quarter of foreign affairs is a suspense account. But this bill here doesn't speak to the discretion that accounting officers have to fire funds. Now, the Committee on Appropriations, would they have now any would there be any linkage between the work of the Committee of Appropriations and the discretion already granted to the accounting officer to buy 8% within program?
It doesn't seem like we are able to conclusively come up, arrive at it. I don't know, it's difficult. And this was a past matter, and I don't think you can park the vehicle twice. You go out of the parking bay, you want to go back to the bay. Change the parking bay.
I think you have to discuss with the discussion with the but as far as shifting to 50% department consent, I think when the committee is during October, you know, then they can tell or they can say because of 1, 2, 3, we think if it is fine, we can see that the extent which they can see the fund for the percentage. I think it's still 50%, unless they're comparing the results to 10%. But I think the key will be the one department or when committee sits down and look at the president.
So the 8% is actually for the accounting. That's an internal. the amendment of the committee is going to an outcome. Rather, let me say, during the period, whether the committee would be able to amend the entire, by the vote, or, I think that's where we are actually trying to find
Mr. Chair, what you're saying now is the one maybe hypothetical problem that we might have, because the one thing that you can get that, hypothetically, if a committee changes the whole budget of that department or departments under the committee, and it comes back to the appropriation committee and they said, you haven't applied your mind correctly, so you can have a huge problem, because I don't want to express myself on the abilities of other committee, the members of other committees to, in terms of their financial skills and abilities to apply that. But you're actually giving a mandate to a committee to say, go and apply your mind, whether they've got the skills and the knowledge or not. And I know from experience that many, many other committees don't have that skill. And then it would come back to the appropriation committee and say, yes, what have they done? They have interpreted the fiscal framework and the objectives totally incorrect. So and I think that is something that we have to guard against, because then you can, you leave the whole system open for either abuse or huge conflict between committees and eventually the appropriation committee and the budget office, and that is, I don't think we want that as a consequence.
Yeah, that's why I don't know whether we'll find people to actually deploy in the budget office. If we have a strong budget office, we will be able to operate that situation, because that committee, in order to apply its mind, would also tap into the wisdom of the budget committee before. And when the appropriations committee also looked at whether the framework has actually been taken into account, that expertise that should be like the capital.
Thank you,
sir.
Just a comment on the issue of violence. That's really the responsibility of the National Treasury. They oversee that. And the CFMA says violence can happen unless they're 11 Treasury Directs otherwise. So in terms of the Constitution, you serve that function. It might be even more complicated. So when we're thinking of our amendment power, then we should be just that discussion about violence and take note of that. And I see the issue of the unfunded mandate wasn't the case, and that's actually a requirement of the Treasury one. So, I don't know if this is the appropriate forum, but certainly if we are getting into some gearing, unsatisfactory analysis from the departments and the state legislation, I think one must take it up to the Treasury and say, we're not getting what we think you intended with Section 35 of the PSMA. Unless, in the unlikely event that Parliament gets the one-liner and the National Treasury gets a full cost, there has been a bill that I've assisted a committee with where that has happened, where we had a one-liner in the memorandum, and when the committee requested that can we have the details of that, there were 30 or 40 pages of funding exercises that were performed by an outsourced agency. So that's maybe something. And then we get to the budget opposition. The powers of the budget office should then somehow include two things. One is to get that detailed information from departments, and departments must by law be obliged to provide that detail. And if that detail is sensitive, one must think about how to protect that sensitivity up to a point where, of course, it can be public knowledge. But sometimes these things predict further economic consequences or whatever. So they might. Yes, there might be a need just to keep things a little bit under wraps until a new budget year is broken.
Chair,
I think if you want to say committee or parliament can give have that power to change, you know, a departmental program to an extent. To some extent, they should talk in the budget, which will be now not taking over executive power. I think we have to think of the threshold that the treasury talk about, or in other countries would say, you cannot, you know, amend about 20% of the budget or that program. Or you can only decrease. I think we must come up with this because, you know, committees might do that, but we cannot do so much of the departmental funds, because if they are going to change the whole thing, that will be down to the existing point.
But, you know, the example that I made earlier, and I think it makes a good example of this, that the amount might, you know, far exceed the percentage of certain funds, and that's precisely what you want to correct. How do you deal with that? Special adjustments are precisely what you were saying. I mean, even though kind of, there was a percentage of special adjustments, which was either which was objective, but the committee was the biggest concern of the committee was that this is just not on. You look at the previous years, this thing has been going on for ages. There needs to be a time when this comes to a stop. And what does, you know, that's why at some point I was saying, I can talk, we are not crushing.
When I'm looking at the Dominion powers, it strikes me that the one aspect of the Dominion is when you're looking at it from a policy point of view, or you're saying this is a strategic priority, and it's very clear that although the department is performing well, that there's just not sufficient resources going to the department to do their job. It's not a problem with the department delivery or anything like that, but it's simply a question. And I mean, I just think of many of the stuff around domestic violence and stuff like that, which are hugely underfunded in the Justice Department. That, you know, these poor institutions just simply cannot deliver on the laws that are being made to protect people. That's the one issue, that there's insufficient funding on well-managed programs, well-managed government programs as well. But the second issue is when there's a persistent problem with underperformance. That Scopus picks up, you know, I mean, we've been picking it up time and time, that Scopus could probably, we could probably get someone here, and the poor Auditor General could probably come here and give us a good idea of what we should be amending, you know, just from our own memory. You know, there's persistent problems that don't get addressed. Just go on and on, and the department just doesn't seem to respond. And that's a delivery issue, an output issue, but they just don't deliver on the figures. Now, maybe with strategic priorities, when you're looking at programs, you can try and shift, but you're actually not going to have an effect by amending a program on shifting strategic priorities. Unless it's big spending items. And even on matters in which there's persistent undelivery, it might be a smaller matter within a bigger program. So I really think maybe we need to talk this issue at this stage, but I think we do need to think through just how we empower, we're talking about that critical relationship between delivery and also performance against budget. Not only delivery of outcomes, but what your actuals against your budget.
Yeah, I think generally we're trying to address underperformance departments by this bill. Let the departments do to their job. Let committees do their job. Because if we're not trying to say there's this priority area and departments not delivering, we're not amending the bill, won't help us. But let the departments crack the whip so that the people deliver. Otherwise, we're not, this bill is the intention to address the issue.
But, the initial question was the bill of is that this bill is an oversight tool. It is an oversight tool, and in exercising the oversight without this tool, the oversight cannot be adequately implemented. That is the main question. I'd imagine we've answered the question to a very large extent, but that's why we're going to answer it. And I want to agree with the point that, you know, and also one of the big principles that have also changed ever since this started from us. These amendments, I mean, the issue of using these tools, comes as a life when all else is failed, when doing what committees have done their work and failed, when departments have done their work. I mean, this tool says why deploy funds where funds are not going to be utilized, why not deploy funds where funds should be deployed and they're sitting elsewhere where they should otherwise be allocated to where they are required. So, I would want us to say to the drafters who had members, members have spoken, taking what members have said and looking at some of the models that we have drawn, how do we best address this? Did I say something before? I packaged it was in Bay 104. I'm moving it to Bay 700. It has moved.
On the matter, and for information in order to take into account or for to take into account what the committee has said, in previously considering the issue around qualified treason, there's been great care from the side of the committee not to interfere with the powers given in the Constitution to the Treasury to withhold funds. And not to interfere to keep the separation of powers in mind. In thinking about all of that, the powers that's given to Treasury is not about performance. Treasury, within its mandate within government, it cannot withhold funds on account of performance. It can only withhold funds on account of financial mismanagement or breaches of financial regulations, etc. That is its function. It has no, it's impossible in a way for Treasury to withhold funds on account of performance. That, I suppose, is the task of Cabinet, or it is the task of Parliament as the provider of the funds. And in thinking about it, to my mind, it is entirely within the powers of Parliament, as the Keeper of the Purse, as envisaged in the Constitution, to say we can withhold funds on account of poor performance. Put the funds in reserve. It's not interfering with the executive powers around policy, around execution. It's purely within Parliament's power of providing funding to say, we are giving this money, but we are giving it conditionally. In other words, first come and convince us that you will be able to spend this fund this year, or otherwise we are not going to, we will withhold it or put it in reserve. And that is a common function. I mean, it's in the European Parliament, for example, that instrument is used very effectively to get the Commission, the European Commission, to change the way it's behaving around specific issues.
So indeed, we're talking a different way. We have, I think, that makes.
The act of censures of Parliament instead of amending powers of Parliament. We actually say it's an act of censuring against the Parliament. We're criticising, and that to amend a government department's budget is Parliament's highest statement of criticism of the department. So that's, you know, when we're talking about are we overtaking an executive authority to build a budget, our approach would be that to amend the department's budget is to give effect to Parliament's full seriousness and criticism of a particular department. So it doesn't sort of become arguing to me and just adding on this and that and that, and the one thing is a little bit here and a little bit there. But you're not composing a budget, you're censuring a department.
Which is in your line of duty as you conduct your oversight. Which is an instrument of oversight. I think I think that the committee is clear that the qualified fleet is actually not in the future. It is for the 85% that was provided for in the constitution. Okay, let's look at how we structure that. Perhaps in addition to that, you might also look at other instruments with regard to the actual implementation of these powers, because you now agreed that qualified fleet is actually come. I don't know how you're going to call it, what you're going to call it. Yeah. Okay. The next one in the Packet Bay 2 is the process of the hub, or the hub.
For amending the budget itself, but I would call it for technical errors in the book.
about 3 or 4 years ago, we had a bill that referred to the wrong municipality, where it referred to the district municipality instead of the local municipality there. And Treasury asked us to amend it, and we couldn't, in terms of the constitution, we didn't have a procedure in place. So just to capture that, otherwise we can just put it as a little bit of a sort of a miscellaneous clause at the end of the book, say the minister, now nothing in this book prevents the minister to move or to suggest textual corrections to the book, to the House or to the committee. What's the vote?
Okay, that's it on the process of the house. We move to Ms. Hogan.
Just a question of political parties. Are political parties allowed to come with motivation to the appropriation committee or any individual?
The situation as it things stand now and out of the
situation is sometimes we operate in a bit of a vacuum where nobody's actually given me a proper context. I'm talking now as a parliamentary official here on this day. Parliament is my which I sometimes speak out of personal opinion because nothing to do with my work. Now the issue then from my side is looking at the budget office. Who does the budget office report? Whatever we do through Moneyball, budget office might be asked or probably will be asked to support that. So what we've seen in the Canadian example is that they prioritize your financial appropriation committee on request to assist other committees as well, and in exceptional circumstances, individual senators or members of parliament. Now there we can look at that. In our example, what we do also have at times, and I don't know if you want to put it in the rules or in the law itself, look at other parliamentary structures. And parliamentary structures would include your joint work forum, include study groups. I think that's a political structure. So one can look at that, and I mean, a political party would bring an agreement obviously to its members in the House. And unless that happens, understand that part clearly. But what is necessary is that you might have an amendment that's discussed at a different forum and it needs support there. I mean, this is simple. How can we get that support in which forum, whatever other structures there might be? I really think we're going to use a toothpaste clause. There's such a thing. It means sort of an umbrella term just to cover those. Otherwise, what's going to see is the budget office overburdened when you get a request from an individual member to assist. They'll say, look, I'm sorry, this is not in my job description, and I'm overburdened, I cannot help. So it might be overburdened, but employ someone because it is part of their duties as a budget officer. That's a big issue.
Parliamentary protocol.
So you have another opportunity before the appropriation. Mm-hmm. And we've agreed in
because if doubt is not even if doubt is not it is doubt the constitution provides for punishment.
So, Chair, our understanding of the backup for committees is that the portfolio committees will be back up in terms of appropriation work and amendment work by their research partners. And that the appropriations committee and finance committee will be backed up by the budget office. Unless a specific request comes through to the budget office from the portfolio committee for something else.
Okay,
just go back to your original question about the process in the House. My proposal was that it would not be in legislation, but I think it would be a very creative process in each House of Appeals. We settled the question of individual things going before the appropriation committee, not in the House. But we haven't settled what report and what recommendation. Remember, we have a whole project where ministers will stand up and justify the budget. Can I just say, in connection with all of this, we haven't at this stage worked out what role ministers play in this whole budget process. Where they feature, where they appear. Yes, they can comment on any amendments that somebody wants to put through. We've had a process where ministers speak to their budget and their portfolio committee. Are we retaining these procedures? Just maybe we need some creativity to think about what the procedure should be in the House.
Given this now for the budget votes and for the House.
No, you see, because now everything's coming to your Appropriations Committee. The Appropriations Committee gives report to the House. Ministers, if they are going to be there, the ministers are not going to know what amendments are until the House has approved the appropriation. Or do you have a situation where a minister can argue against an amendment in the House? Do you see what I mean? Which comes first and which comes after?
Remember there was once the Immigration Act, the Immigration Book, where when we're talking amendments in general, where that bill was substantially amended. And then the chairperson of the committee, of course, introduces the report. And then the minister gets to respond at the end. I don't know if the same procedure can be followed there, but then the minister obviously has to indicate what he thought of the committee's work at that stage. It was very diplomatic, but it was amended quite substantially, and if I remember the speech correctly, of the minister given the edge of that. Not in bitter at all. He said, well, this is the bill that you've now given me, and this is what we'll have to implement. It's essentially different to the one that they introduced. I don't know if that's a good process or not. I'm thinking about why it would not be a good process, but it doesn't appear to be a bad process. So what one will have to then there do is, within your rules and orders that pertain to every member of the House, the minister must accept that amendment from Parliament. The minister cannot go and argue against Parliament because the minister, barring two of them, must be members of the House. So I don't know if one has to rule there, but we've now amended the budget. We've maybe even to such an extent that certain functions of this department will have to be transferred to another department because this department is not performed. So we have now moved, for example, a bank to another department. But Parliament is then, it's not the Treasury, not the Executive. And by just shifting funds, and in that way, we've said to the President, you must think whether you want to put all those funds in that department which cannot perform. And now the Minister stands before the House and says, well, he's trying to attack in the face and he's considering his resignation. I don't think that's the process to work. I think when one thinks of the process in the House, there should be that kind of, without limiting freedom of speech, but there should be that understanding that this is Parliament has set this out and the Minister must somehow respond to the amendments made by Parliament.
We're not in the NCOP yet at this point. I'm just thinking of the AI. I don't know how to one think of it through it and speak to the experts on procedure in the house on that, the NA table and the NCOP table. If we like to prevent that sort of mustering.
Mr. North said he was just south, or she was just south of the house. Can we include that in legislation? He'll be a record for a vowel. I'm just thinking through. The Appropriations Committee is not the final body that makes decisions. The Appropriations Committee puts it before the House for consideration. So the Appropriations Committee or the Portfolio Committee, then we need to know who needs to make the decision. Okay. Now, do we have 27 in the NA or whatever committee is talking, or does the Appropriations Committee talk, or how does it all get arranged? But the House has to be persuaded that what the Appropriations Committee is arguing is sensible. So shouldn't the Minister have a last-minute attempt to come before the House and say, I don't agree with this? It's not nice. No, you can't. Yeah, the Minister must convince the committee. So the Minister must convince the committee and then it must go before the House.
Yeah.
So what must the House consider when it comes before the House? Just the report of the committee?
Yes.
I think on the The Minister introduces his or her budget in the first reading. I'll check everything carefully. Goes to the committee to amend it. I think then the committee chair starts the debate, motivates the changes, and the Minister gets the last say, the response, and then the House votes after that. So the issue which I mentioned earlier about nothing, that's a political thing. I mean, that's part of why some people watch and some people don't watch. I think that's not a concern for rules or anything. That's part of order in the House, and the Speaker and the Rules Committee can deal with that. But the Minister should. Maybe we should recommend that in the rules, the Minister must be given an opportunity to respond to the report of the committee before voting.
So then you have first reading debate, where the Minister introduces the rest of the committee doesn't talk. The Minister just introduces the budget. Then you can have several budgets. And then the committee responds by the committee. The Appropriations Committee then responds. Or the Portfolio Committee. Well, that we can sort out, okay? It's the Portfolio Committee that argue for their amendment.
Yes, sure. The Appropriations Committee, the Portfolio Committee won't argue for any amendments in the House. There's no debate in the House from them. It's in within the Committee on Appropriations. They come here, they say whatever they want. The Committee on Appropriations will present a report, I would think, the chairperson, on behalf of the committee, after having considered all the proposals and amendments and ministers' comments and everybody, and say, on the budget, this is what we're recommending. For certain departments, we move here, the other department, and then the separate budget votes can take place.
In order for it to go. go to the executive to be responded to in February. Would that not be the portfolio committee's moment of really looking at the strategic plan budget and performance of the department, and then in the actual budget process, the appropriation committee?
Yeah, the challenge that I see is that let's assume the appropriations committee doesn't come through with any amendment. Does that then mean when the budget vote is being presented to the House, the portfolio committee don't participate? That's the challenge that I'm seeing. Let's say the appropriations committee doesn't come through it. Yes. But, okay, see, the second part, even if they are amended, because the appropriations committee coming into the overall picture, and then what happens to the individual budget goals? How do you put them in the proposed process? You see, because there are two processes in the House. One, I mean, the traditional is that we have budget goals today, and then at the end, we have this long session, you can take a decision on the whole. So I think we need to draw a distinction between that, and I don't know how we're going to manage that process, because then otherwise we end up keeping the budget, the portfolio committee out of the whole process.
You can't exclude the portfolio committee, the process of the assessment. Maybe let's go back to the question that what it is that we want to do with the current process. What refinements do you want to see in the current process for the overhaul of the
The answer to the situation, I don't think portfolio committee should be excluded from the debate. The chair is under a suspicion. They really know what is going on, and a lot of issues be beyond amendments that they would want to speak on. And yes, the Ministry of Budget Policy statement, the statement of the budget, what is calling the budget review and recommendation, that should be installed as a high moment in Parliament, where portfolio committee chairs stand up and say, this is what we would want to see, and this is in October, coming through on the budget, and that's where they have the experience in it. And that needs to be elevated to a much more substantive debate, and a powerful debate, because that's the moment. But I'm concerned the possibility that the portfolio committee doesn't like what the appropriations committee has decided about their recommendations. And then the appropriations committee reports and the portfolio committee comes and whinges like mad about what the appropriations committee is doing. Then you have a minister coming along and whinging like mad about what the portfolio is doing, but also doesn't like what the appropriations committee is doing. It gets messy all along the line. But I think we need to go back to the principle of what do we want people to participate in the debate? What is it that we want the House to consider in that debate? I'm not sure if we're on top of that yet. We know that the Minister must have an opportunity to respond to the appropriations committee. We know that the portfolio committee must be able, there must be a debate in the House.
The individual portfolio committee was an appropriation forum.
When the portfolio committee consider a budget, that's not a decision making forum. Those are committees, those are extended committees. The decision making takes place in the House when we're considering all the votes. And that is why the appropriations committee's recommendation that they would hold will actually feature more prominently than the budget vote. That's the bit.
Thank you, Chair. The process at the moment, of course, we're working with on the figure issue, the extended public committee. Now, I think that's going to largely be taken over by the appropriations. In the town appropriation, if they want to make a budget, I'm not sure whether that would happen. But the way I read what we've done so far in the book is that obviously there's a consultation between portfolio committees and your committee on appropriations. And the committee on appropriations define the rules, requires a standing rule to look into that, and of course there's nothing prevents a portfolio committee to actually move an amendment through the appropriation committee, and then the appropriation committee to report to them that to say, for these reasons we don't think the House should listen to this. What I'm trying to get to is the process in the House must definitely allow the portfolio committee to stand up and make a statement on the performance of that department over and above your report in October and November. So if we refer to that report, we wanted this budget to be amended, the appropriations committee didn't agree. Appropriations committee can make a statement to the House and say, well, these are the reasons why we think the House should not agree. And of course, the minister gets time to respond. The minister gets time to respond to all these reports in any case, and those comments are included in the report. But for the process in the House, the minister, I would agree that it's difficult for the minister to have the floor to respond to whatever has happened in Parliament. So I would agree with that sentiment that the portfolio committee or select committee must have an opportunity to say what its view is over and above the issue of saving their report in October, but for the recommendation, the fiscal recommendation report. The question is also for other members whether they should have a moment. I honestly don't know how to exclude them if the issue is about performance and not about rand and cents, what we said earlier today. Because I see the appropriation committee just dealing with rand and cents in the end of the day.
Okay, look, one of the things you said also with regard to the Fatwa Commission, the engagement with the department, should not lose sight of the fact that there is a number of points at which they engage. After the changing of the budget, the department tabled their strategic plan for the Fatwa Commission. I don't know what you would want to recommend in the process going forward. What's the engagement between the Fatwa Commission and the department for the strategic plan? Oversight is an ongoing process between the committee and the department. It never stops. But then, so many of the cases that we should then make the passage of the changing of the annual report, measuring the department against measuring the department performance should also be actually be elevated to a level that is higher than what it is. I don't know. But let's come back to how then these different points of oversight find their way into the process of and which debate should go to the House and how they should also be.
Mr. Chair, can I just just to make sure for myself, well, we say that the Minister must be able to get the opportunity to respond, but hopefully there will be an opportunity between the Appropriations Committee and the Minister to also maybe sort out their differences if there are differences, so that Parliament's not a place for mudslinging between the Minister and the Appropriation Committee, because that is very important. So one must just make sure that we build that contact with the Minister as well.
Parking bay number three, one of the things, some of the things actually we cover as we deal with the others, because in parking bay number three we had looked at the issue of the budget officer. Actually touched on quite a number of things that I was mentioning in your refining the bill and the other one, the parking bill number four, was the fiscal framework in the definition to include and we have agreed that we need to see that definition. And
the rainy days, I'm looking at checking the rainy days amendment. We've also done that because it says, I think that the one we accommodated under the textual amendment. So, we've dealt with that. And then the implementation, you spoke about the issue of phasing in the establishment of the budget office. And, I think that's also a point because we cannot expect this to actually happen all at the same time. And I don't know how that can happen to the education, but maybe we need to do that. Are there any suggestions or recommendations? Comments? The cafe is outside if you want to do that after cafe, it's up to you, but you can start.
Can I just ask, maybe it's a bit of a devil's advocate, because for phasing in this, you must obviously first appropriate funds for the establishment of a budget office, and that will start the phasing in for that. So it can be, it obviously must be properly managed and well structured, but it can be complicated as well.
Also, I mean, in every legislation to form this budget committee must also be in place if we can actually point people to it, otherwise, on what basis are you going to do it?
My personal opinion, I don't think it's necessary to be putting into this legislation the issues of placing in certain powers or the I think let's leave it to the appropriations committee to say this is what we'll be given our capacity, this is what we'll be able to do. And as it develops, then we can be. Otherwise, I don't know how we're going to do it. I mean, to say we can't do 1, 2, 3 because we don't have the budget office in place, it gets us too complex. Okay.
That's a useful comment. I was thinking the appropriations committee could also outsource in the initial phases of the different agencies to provide analysis for them at each time the budget office is up and running.
Well, to the extent that the bill provides for the Secretary of Parliament to establish the budget office, I'm not so certain whether you can want to do that for legislation, the kind of people that might be appointed, and I don't think that's desirable.
As long as we have the proper term of reference for the budget office, we have
there was that task table oversight and accountability, which the production of this legislation was part of that process. And I know during that process there was a fairly serious look at the budget office being established under the chair. Would it be possible for us just to have a report in parliamentary or whoever is driving that process to come before this committee to just explain to us where we are in that process? Included in our report, not in the legislation, but in our report, so also in terms of goes in the NA, you can decide what goes in education, what goes in your course, in the house.
I've been reading a little bit about budget office. The Canadian example is actually quite explicit where it will be. It must be in the library, it's in the research section. The American example says who must be the head of that office and how it should be appointed and how the term of office and so on. And it's, and it should be nonpartisan, meaning it should be independent from the Treasury. So these are issues, these are examples that you can put it in legislation. But when we're looking at the budget office here, I mean, committees are receiving support from certain divisions within Parliament. At this point in time, it's mostly from the LOB, legislation and oversight, from your research, which is also our library, and then the committee section, which is also within your LOD. You know, that much like departments, there are problems with that level of service. I'm not sure whether stipulating in legislation would solve it. Because we still visit the same parliament you serve with all respect. So one must think, what do you want in there and what do you want in the report? And what's the value of that report? But certainly I would follow up on the recommendation that must be within the
Let's follow up on the recommendation. What is the recommendation? Isn't that that would also have been formulated our position as regards to where we want to
be? There's three things that I've been looking at when it comes to budget office. One is the functions. I think that's very important to set up the functions. The second one is the structure itself. Where is it located? Does it fall under the accounting officer of Parliament, or is it the independent agency in the Congressional Budget Office and so on? What are the implications there? And then thirdly, if it is a different structure than a division or a section within Parliament, how do we establish that division and section? Because then you cannot give that to the responsibility of the accounting officer. But as a drafter, at the moment, it is the responsibility of the accounting officer. And then the issue of timelines do come in. We're saying in this bill at the moment, the Secretary of Parliament must establish a budget office. It must establish in the country. It used to be the Secretary of Parliament is responsible for establishing a budget office. Now it reads the Secretary of Parliament must establish a budget office within the administration of Parliament. So it's a future thing. But we must just look at that. I mean, the wording must reflect the intention. If we say it must establish a budget office, other legislation sometimes just say there is a budget office. And that's something else. That's your genitive complex. Let there be none. But it doesn't happen that quickly. So then we must just think, how are we going to bring it into operation?
Can we ask also
about
the
about the budget office and where it would be situated, is that if it's separated from National Treasury, which it probably should be, what happens if they come up with a different conclusion? So for example, if they're doing research, they look at macroeconomic things and they reach a conclusion that is different to one reached by Treasury. I'm not saying they would, but it's possible. I don't know what the solution is, but I think there could possibly be an issue there somewhere. Thanks, Chair.
I don't think we should preempt that. That's very mischievous, Dr. Jones. I don't think we should preempt it because anything can happen. But I think what's critical from our side is that we would want to have it. And I don't think we would then be able to say how they should think, because if they're in that situation, I don't know. To be honest, but we'll think about some of those things, but let's agree now what the process from there is going to be.
The drafters are now going to go and incorporate the things that we have raised today. And when we meet, which we are now going to the first break and have some coffee and come back and decide when we are going to meet. When we meet, we should then be able to first go through the build that incorporate the stuff that we have decided on. And then we would then have to go through the close by close. And that should actually lead us to some way, which is where we're heading. So let's break for coffee, apply our minds, come back and map the way forward. Yeah. That when we return, what is going to be the process going forward. I think there's a complete agreement that we have made considerable progress. One member is actually qualified to say we've made 95%. The other one said 90. So that's an indication that we are getting so what we are now going to do we're going to request that the doctors go and incorporate what we have raised. And then originally we had said that we might request a day due to non-availability of some of the doctors or one of the doctors and some other logistical problems. We think that in the committee we should request another extension. We will due to report by the 29th. That we request another extension, which is not unusual. Ask for another extension, but I think I should hear from members how far that extension should go, but then to finalize this. That the committee period commences on the 9th of September, and we have Wednesday the 10th, which is free for us. So we imagine that will be the first day for us to meet and reach some finality, because there also won't be any plenary. So in the absence of plenary for us, we can make it on the day. There is an objection on my left.
If the committee would like me to be present, I'm not in Cape Town that week. That's the 1 week until the end of September that I'm not here. Yeah, the week is the 9th.
You are not around from the 9th until the end of September?
No, I'm from the 8th until I'm back on the 15th of September.
Okay, there is a proposal that we look at Wednesday the 17th, and then perhaps we can shift either Friday the 19th or to Wednesday the 10th, depending whether they will be available on the 10th. Okay, the recommendation is that we then do it on the 17th, but then the request for an extension should actually cover us beyond that. Shouldn't we then be requesting for until the end of September? That's what we need. That's what we need to just to tie the bond. But can I request that once there is a document that we could be circulated so that members can read it to the discussion, so that when we meet, we are able to recommended that where there are options where don't include them in the document, you have a separate document that talks to some of the options and to never have requested that you give us those options. Is there anything you want to say to ourselves why you can't do that? Okay, that then brings us to the end of the session. I want to thank members, you know, your contribution and the lady and the gentleman on my left, you know, for the amount of what you've put into this so far. Look forward to reaching our destination in the not so far or distant future. Members, one of the things we've done, we've circulated the regulations that have been gazetted, and you know that those, if they are gazetted now, they would require our attention if we need to. The other one is the regulations made under 86 of the Cooperative Banks Act. The other one is on the Income Tax Act, which should describing administrative penalties in respect of non-compliance in terms of the legislation we have passed. I would want members to indicate if they would want us to have any engagement with the Treasury Office. We presented on the 1st and the other one on the 13th. Normally, regulations are gazetted and we are given how many days? 30. And if we don't comment, they become law. So members must read those, and if they really feel that there are issues in the regulations, then they feel the committee should meet and check whether either it undermines or it goes against the spirit of the legislative principle. And please, members, feel free to do so. The other one is the Financial Management of Parliament Bill. We recall that we had consulted with the minister, and the minister had responded and the committee had also agreed on the minister's recommendation. And I would want also to recommend that when we return, the committee also consider that. I don't know whether Advocate Jenkins, you want to say something on the financial management of Parliament.
Thank you, Chair. Briefly, the Minister's comment as agreed to by the committee have suggested changes to the bill which incorporates them. I don't see a problem with those either. There have been issues that were raised by the Secretary to Parliament politically, and I don't know whether the committee or when or what the process is going to involve there. And as I indicated time back, I know that there were discussions within the Speakers Forum about the role of provinces within the bill, and I'm not sure what has happened to that. That might be an issue for the NCOP to consider when the bill goes there.
Look, I don't know what committee members feel, because we had agreed on these two, except for one thing where we would recall Advocate Jenkins that there were those areas where there was reference to the PFMA and there was a feeling that we should just write it out in the bill instead of referring to it. Can I recommend that the committee agrees to that, so that we just write down everything in the PFMA. We don't necessarily refer to the PFMA, but write it in the bill as it appears in the PFMA. You want to talk to the particular section?
Chair, there's four areas, what I was saying, where the PFMA was brought back. These are Article 16 to 8 Parliament budget must be in accordance with the format prescribed under Section 76 of the Regulations Section 2073 of the PSM. Clause 47.5 of the bill is the terms of appointment and remuneration of members of the Audit Committee must be consistent with such requirements prescribed under the PSM. Clause 50, internal audit must be conducted in accordance with standards prescribed for public entities in terms of the PSM. And then the financial, clause 56.1, financial statements must be prepared in accordance with generally recognized accounting practice and in the format prescribed in terms of the PSM. So the issue to write those out is to bring in what is written, sort of the flesh, in the PSMA without referring just to the PSMA and going and getting that organ out of the PSMA and making a carbon copy and putting it into the top level. Can be done, but I'll have to go look at the regulations. It's probably quite a lot of detail. So one will, one can just do it and I can come up with a proposal to the committee. See if it works. Alternatively, one must give the regulation making powers pertaining to these four areas I've highlighted now to the regulation making issues within the top level, and then in that clause there, create some kind of direction, detail of what we want in there. For instance, your recognized accounting practice. There is only one recognized accounting practice. That is an answer. But there's the one that's in the PFMA, the Accounting Standards Board. I mean, that's there. Now, we don't want to refer to the standards set in terms of the PFMA by the Accounting Standards Board, but established in terms of the PFMA. What do we do then? Do we then say that it must be in accordance with the standards prescribed by the Executive Authority, which must, and then list those issues, that flesh that we find in the regulations? So I need some work on it, see where we can put it into the book, but I think I'm going to switch up my mic now.
I was just on my way out, and just, I was a member of the Council of Standards Board, I think it's about a week or two, so I have a good amount of questions on this. It's going to be extremely difficult for lesbians in legislation, accounting standards. You know, what accounting standards, accounting standards refers to the way in which every issue in accounting is dealt with. Depreciation, how should we, all of this. I mean, the Accounting Standards Board has been sitting at this now for about 45 years. You have to send out, you certainly have your own accounting standards, you've got to send out things to people, to interested bodies, you've got to then reflect on it, you've got to have a whole team of accountants working on it. This is probably the only institution in the world that wants to establish its own accounting standards. And the documents itself, when you're talking about accounting standards, you see, you deal with the various international standard setting bodies that South Africa interacts with, and the accounting standards board interacts with all the time. So you're sitting with documents this thick, that reflect accounting standards. So I'm not sure how, do you need to say the accounting standards board set up by the PFMA? You can just refer to established by the accounting standards board. You can remove the word PFMA because there is a statutory body called the accounting standards body, so just put accounting standards, that will get you out of the whole next thing. I haven't, what I would plead that we apply our minds to is that if an audit general is an audit, the things part, there is two things that the audit general needs. He needs, or she needs, accounting standards, recognized accounting standards, and needs to know the framework in which Parliament is doing its standards, and that becomes an issue. The auditing standards itself, the Parliament now going to establish its own auditing standards. So those are separate from accounting standards, anyway. But the other issue is that the Auditor General, as you know, has to report on how compliant every institution is with the PFMA or the MFMA. The compliance report is part of the Auditor General's report. Now, the dilemma that the Auditor General might face is that when he comes to audit the external, the accounting standards and the auditing standards, but if there are no Treasury norms standards that are adopted by Parliament, then he can't audit. And my understanding, when you look at the Constitution, it says National Treasury must establish uniform norms and standards, Treasury norms and standards for all organs of state. Parliament is an organ of state. I might be taking it back on this. But all I'm pleading is they're just taking the dilemma that the Auditor General's office is going to have in trying to deal with this conundrum of an institution that wants to set its own standards and Treasury norms and whatever. Because I think it might put the Auditor General in the institution.
I'll propose that before we go further, I mean, I'm not going to do another institution, I'm going to have to tell you to give the bill with the proposed amendment to the executive for the intervention to review the getting too complex for me. I would say that let's give it to the professionals so that you have to make it and certain opinion and let's say what is the best of all. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. My understanding was that we had the PFMA, reference to the PFMA in there because we wanted to make sure that there were certain accounting standards as we just discussed. Now, we can take it out and make other reference to it, but as the PFMA evolves over time, you might very well get out of step with what is good in the, according to the PFMA and what Parliament is doing. And so therefore you'd have to make a change to the one that we're doing. So I think that would just be a concern in my mind. The issue was about prudence, and there were certain good things in the PFMA that we wanted to replicate. If we take out that reference, then we are kind of, it's on its own, and it's, they are dovetailing until there's a change to the PFMA, and then they actually are different. And I think we must bear that in mind. Thanks, Chair.
You know, one way, if you don't want to have the word PFMA mentioned, but you want to use the PFMA, what's actually in the PFMA, I don't know if you can do it this way, is that you have the bill, but have attached to the bill the regulation that are actually the PFMA regulations, but that Parliament assumes. You see, there's two things here. One is accounting standards, and that's how you define items that you have to account for financially. The other is uniform Treasury norms and standards. Now, if the intention is that it be a similar, and that's what I understand it to be, to the PFMA, if you don't want to refer to the PFMA because of the separation of powers or anything, what you could do is, could you have the bill and then have for the Speaker to promulgate as regulation the equivalent of the Treasury norms and standards, but that it's just attached to the bill as a set of regulations that go through as a whole to the House. So the speaker is actually promulgating regulations. And you could look at it from any of those other things that would be the same thing. So you're not referring to the speaker, but you have it there so that it's clear for all to see. I don't know if I'm complicating things here.
But this is one of the things that one of the channel would really have to finalize. So can I then add an extra burden on your desk on the kitchen to then prepare a document that takes this one month and when you return will produce it also and we would like to put this. Okay. Members, I think we have come to the end of the day's work. The program that has been circulated is provisional and will change when the chairperson will come on the event. No, but that's the program. The only thing we have to look at is that date of the 17th more than the 10th general fund. That's the program going forward. Thank you very much, and have a busy constituency period. And, DA does still our votes, IFC does still our votes. We also undertake to steal a little bit of yours. But all over. Okay. we did our.
Hey, we've got conference. Yeah.
Yeah. You have conference?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, the food is here.
I'm going to How can you get away from the subjective thing?
I don't know. But I'm certainly not asking them enough. Explain to me how I must get away from it.
It's an interesting point, Simon. Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Politically, how? form of the we were saying the cycling is right now. It's very real. And also allowing for more information to be done. And that is why it's not only the different server, but it's also the different content. Because those two are our major program. And with the different level, I agree with the different content. Connection has to change.
Okay. So, you looking for a program?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll get you a note.
Okay, sir. So, when do you need?
No, we were trying to because we wanted to have it. And then God got to say, no, I don't think so because we need to allow for also to do it.
Thank you.
nothing was inside.
Thank you.
Gracias. So eventually they get the town to draw and they put them to the master moves and they start all over again, the rope goes back, so that's the one right. We get a lesser yesterday. We have less key value as a result. The value of the property, which was at 50 million rand for the quarter share, is now 0.003 cents. We have to start drawing on accounts again.
Is this a joke?
No, that's a joke.
It's a quick search, and yet my husband has got a bill, a rate bill of $480 billion for the same property, which is now worth 0.03 Zimbabwe cents.
But what if the property looks like it's worth
It's a suburban property. The house is very old. It would have to be completely updated, but it's a nice spot. So for a developer, it's great. If anyone else, it's a pain in the neck.